Welcome to Inside the Guard, the show that takes an in-depth look at the biggest fights from a weekend of MMA action. I am your host, TP Grant. Thank you for listening or watching on YouTube or on Bloody Elbow or however it is you are taking part in this show. So thank you for being patient with my little layoff there. I apparently missed a pretty darn good card in the UFC on Fox, and we're back for what was, in all honesty, not a fantastic card overall, but we all kind of knew that going in. Not really anyone's fault that this card was terrible, just mainly because it was absolutely devastated by injury. And, I mean, there was just a total lack of excitement. I kind of felt like around this card. Now, obviously, it was in Montreal, Canada. The Canadian crowd was very, very excited to be getting a card again, just because the UFC has kind of seemingly given up a little bit on the Canadian market in terms of really diligently going there and giving them quality cards. And unfortunately, kind of the lead up to a lot of this was very focused on Demetrius Johnson and his ability to inspire excitement amongst fans. And frankly, for the most part, DJ gets a really terrible rap for being a boring fighter, because he's not a boring fighter. He really is as close to a perfect fighter that we have in MMA. I mean, he's not bad at any phase of MMA, and there's usually not a phase he isn't dominant in his fights. It's really a case of he just doesn't have much, you know, kind of charisma about him in terms of when he's giving interviews or things like that. I mean, just comparing his post-fight interview to Rampage's, where Rampage put on a thoroughly mediocre fight, which we're going to talk about later, but the guy's just so captivating when he talks. There's just this kind of natural, like, aura he puts out that makes you want to listen to him and makes him likable and interesting that Demetrius Johnson just doesn't have. And it kind of stinks, because when you talk about it like this, it's very easy for people to misconstrue it as you're talking about Demetrius Johnson the fighter. And I'm not. Demetrius Johnson the fighter is outstanding. We're going to go into depth about his side control, which I think is just the way he controls people from the top is just brilliant. And the way he fights is just awesome. But the numbers, in terms of like the traffic, looking at the live numbers for Bloody Elbow and the level of interest, it was not good at all. It was terrible, in fact. The number of people kind of checking out, it was significantly worse than the Crow Cop card in Poland in terms of numbers of people, you know, jumping on the play-by-play or checking out results. Significantly worse than the UFC Krakow card. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. And there were multiple reports from journalists who were in the arena at the time that after Rampage finished the fight and it was time for the main event, that there was a significant portion of the crowd that got up and walked out before Demetrius Johnson fought. So it's pretty clear at this point that he isn't a draw. And that's going to happen sometimes in this sport. There are going to be really good fighters who just don't spark interest in the, you know, average fan out there. And so at this point, I would expect us not to be seeing Demetrius Johnson headlining pay-per-views anymore. And I know he wasn't supposed to headline this pay-per-view. There was an injury that caused him to be headlining this pay-per-view. But I kind of expect the UFC to kind of send him back to Fox. Or, I mean, do him a service and, like, put him under a really big fight. Not, like, Dillashaw-Barrow rematch that almost no one wanted. Like, next time you're putting together a card like the UFC 187 with, you know, Anthony Johnson and John Jones and Chris Weidman and Vitor Belfort, put Demetrius Johnson on a card like that. Now, obviously, we all learned from Strikeforce you never put three title fights on one card, but, like, you know, put him on there with a big time fight and let a lot of fans kind of see him fight again, because I feel like there's this big misconception about his fights and about how he's not entertaining or not exciting, when really his fights are really quite excellent. So let's talk about his excellent fight, because Koji Horiguchi gave him a pretty good little scrap there, but I mean, Demetrius Johnson was just able to kind of take that over. We're going to go in depth at the end of this episode. We're going to take a really good look at DJ's side control game, which is absolutely outstanding. But let's talk kind of briefly real quick about the bigger fight. I thought Johnson early on was very, very cautious with Horiguchi's kind of explosion. Horiguchi, for, I mean, he, they talked a lot about his karate background, and what that really kind of asserts itself in MMA is that he plays at distance, and he likes to explode in, which is kind of, you know, I think most fans now know that about karate guys, that they kind of like to play way outside and then kind of jump in. But Horiguchi does it on kind of like a broken rhythm. There's a really outstanding video that Conor Ebush did about rhythm and striking and the idea of breaking rhythm. So I'm not going to get too into depth in that. I will post a link to the video in the article because it's outstanding. And basically, you know, everything you do in fighting for the most part kind of has a natural rhythm to it. You know, when you're hitting pads with your coach or something like that, there is kind of you get kind of in a rhythm, and you know, you get that 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, almost like you're dancing. And Horiguchi very much, he breaks that rhythm, and he does it with kind of a casualness that makes it seem like it comes very naturally to him. So it's why he's able to make guys look so bad when he leaps in a lot of times, because he kind of does it at awkward moments for fighters. And most guys that are kind of arrhythmic fighters, we tend to term as being awkward fighters. The classic example I think of, for anyone who's kind of been around MMA long enough would think of, is Keith Jardine, would be an arrhythmic fighter. He had a very weird rhythm, and he fought kind of very off rhythm of a lot of other fighters, but he also looked really awkward. And Horiguchi doesn't look awkward. His technique's very, very clean, but he does things at kind of awkward times for other fighters, and it's a good thing. I mean, this is like, if you make your opponent uncomfortable, you're going to have success. So very early on, Johnson was very kind of like testing things out. He'd throw a strike and see how Horiguchi countered. He'd leap in and actually wouldn't really throw a strike and see how Horiguchi reacted. And you could kind of tell he was kind of gauging all of Horiguchi's reactions. And Horiguchi, I mean, clipped him a couple times. There was that, I don't remember which round it was in, but that charging knee where he timed Johnson dropping down for a takedown perfectly. But for the most part, as the fight went into the second, third, and fourth round, you could see Johnson become demonstrably more comfortable with Horiguchi's rhythm. And he started walking Horiguchi down to the fence, kind of, you know, cutting him off, trapping him against the cage. And once he was there, Johnson would unload a couple quick strikes and then clinch up. And once he had Horiguchi clinched, he did not want to give Horiguchi space to operate. Overall, I thought it was a pretty masterful showing on Demetrius Johnson's part. He's quite literally the perfect fighter at this point. There's nothing he doesn't do well. He adjusts in the fight well. And I mean, we're talking about a guy also who's finishing submissions at a pretty high level of MMA in a sport where submission offense has very much taken a backseat in a lot of fighters' games. And it's one of those where you can tell Demetrius Johnson is just a student of the game. He just wants to learn everything. I mean, he's the kind of dude that you can see him still in a gym after he retires, because he's still going to want to. He's the kind of guy that even after he retires, when he's done fighting, you can kind of tell he's going to be in the gym sharpening up his armbar because, you know, it's still not perfect, or getting in there and wanting to learn the latest weird grappling technique that's in vogue right now, because, you know, that's what he does. So it's really fun and refreshing to see a champion like that, because not everyone is like that. Some guys are in it, you know, for different reasons, you know, be it money or, you know, for the competition. You can tell Johnson, he's a total fight nerd. Dude wants to just know everything there is to know about fighting, and it comes out in his fights. Let's see, moving down the card, we'll come back to Johnson in a little bit, but moving down the card, the co-main event of this, obviously Quentin Rampage Jackson versus Fabio Maldonado, a fight that we weren't sure this fight was going to happen. Obviously Jackson had a lot of stress coming in, talking about all the legal proceedings and all of that. I mean, I'd be willing to give Jackson a pass on some level because of all the stuff kind of leading into this fight, but I mean, this was a showcase fight for him. This was a fight where they wanted Rampage to look good in. They gave him the best possible matchup in the division. Fabio Maldonado was going to play exactly the game Quentin Rampage Jackson wants to play. He's going to stand there. He's going to trade punches. And Rampage struggled with him at times. And I don't know if that's a function of him maybe letting down on his training a little bit because of the court proceedings, or having just kind of like the court proceedings hanging over his head. To me, when I watch Rampage fight, I mean, he's aging in a way. I mean, in some ways, he looks kind of like an old boxer in the sense of you're talking about a guy that has simplified his fight game. You know, he's kind of pared it down to its bare essentials to kind of make it more repeatable and more consistent as he ages and physically, you know, declines. And I don't think there's any argument against the idea that at 36, Rampage is not the same dude he was 12, 13 years ago when he was powerbombing dudes in Japan. So I think that part of it is also that Rampage is not one of those dudes that is staying on the cutting edge of MMA. He developed his game in 2007 that he won the UFC championship with, which is a very boxing-based game, very flat-footed stance. He wants to deliver power hooks inside. He wants to kind of get in close with dudes and kind of sit down on his punches. And he doesn't want to grapple. He doesn't want to clinch with guys. He's going to disengage from takedowns, which is all fine. It's a perfectly viable sort of game in MMA, and we're going to talk about that kind of idea with Michael Bisping, but Rampage hasn't really been evolving it to account for the changes in the sport. I mean, we're talking about a dude that, you know, as he's not fighting that dramatically different than he did in 2007 when he knocked out Chuck Liddell in UFC 71. He's not fighting that dramatically different from when he fought Keith Jardine or Lyoto Machida, even like, you know, 4, 5, 6 years ago. He's not continuing to expand his skill set, and the sport's just changing around him. I still think Rampage is enough of an athlete. I mean, this guy is quite possibly one of the best athletes that's gone into the sport at this point, and easily could have been one of the best light heavyweights of all time. I mean, and still probably is, considering the division and the short history of the sport. But I mean, like, this guy, he still can fight. I think part of the reason why he's looking so poor is the fact that he's really not kind of working on expanding his game. He's kind of staying very stagnant while the sport's changing around him. And now we're getting to the point where even like mid-level dudes in the light heavyweight division who play a game ideally suited for him to beat have enough tools to kind of stop Rampage from landing that left hook, right hook combination that he likes throwing. And I mean, like, it's another case of Rampage got away. Like, he obviously developed some good boxing. He has some nice footwork. He has some nice head movement. He's very comfortable in the pocket. And he was doing that, I mean, man, before it was even, like, really in vogue. Like, we're talking, you know, 2006, 2007, standing in the pocket in MMA was something you did if you had just an absolute granite chin, which Rampage does. But he also did it with some craft. But, I mean, even going back to, like, 2003, I mean, Rampage was all about the ground damage. Just, like, creative violence on the ground to just demolish guys. I mean, think about making Chuck Liddell's corner throw in the towel because he was just absolutely crushing Liddell's kidneys and liver from the half guard. I mean, that was Rampage kind of at his peak in terms of, like, diversity of game. And I mean, obviously, a lot's changed since then. So I think Rampage, he's just simplified his game to the point where he's not evolving anymore. And he'll be able to get fights and do well because he's such a compelling figure. But, I mean, I think it's pretty clear. His time as a high-level mixed martial artist is pretty much done at this point. Doesn't mean I won't watch him fight. I mean, there's still some good fights for him to be made out there. But they're going to have to steer him clear of anyone who's, you know, top 5, top 6 in that division. Otherwise, it's going to be a rough night for Rampage. All right, going from Rampage, who has a game that's not aging well, to Michael Bisping, to a fighter whose game is aging really, really well. I think Michael Bisping is going to become like a case in point, like a textbook example of a guy who, of a fighter who is able to leverage a good, sound process towards fighting to get wins into a really, really long MMA career. I mean, we're already talking, he's been fighting 11 years professionally. Bisping's clearly on the downside of his career. He's 36. He's not in there with elite dudes. He is in there with elite dudes. He's just not able to compete with those elite dudes. And, I mean, it's debatable how much he ever was able to compete with, like, the tippity top of the division. But, I mean, there was times he was being considered for title shots. And, I mean, it's just clear with Bisping, there's a ceiling of at what level he can fight. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I mean, being top five in the division is outstanding. I mean, there's quite literally like five or six guys in the world who can fight at that level currently. And not being a part of that doesn't make Michael Bisping a bad fighter. It just means that he has certain limitations. And he has just crafted a style that is so perfectly made for his particular type. And it gets results. I mean, like, he is able to consistently win decisions and occasionally pile up enough damage to get a stoppage, you know, get those kind of volume stoppages on guys. And, I mean, it's based around a couple key things. Number one, good movement. Bisping is always moving. He's always cutting angles. He's never stationary in there. Number two is volume. He's always throwing strikes. He's always outworking his opponents. And they made a big, big deal about that in the broadcast, talking about, you know, Bisping's cardio and his amazing resting heart rate and all this stuff. But it is valuable that Bisping's style is built around a high work rate, and he has been diligent in keeping himself in a good enough shape to just keep that work rate up. Sound disengagement grappling. Bisping has no interest in getting into ground fights. He knows how he wins fights. His grappling game is completely based around defense, not getting finished, not making it a point where guys go to win fights quickly, and then disengaging from grappling. And then the last part, Bisping adjusts in fights. He makes in-fight adjustments when he has to. And in the first round of his fight with Dolloway, Bisping was kind of working his in-and-out style, and he was getting in on Dolloway really easily. You could see Bisping was kind of, I think he was surprised at how easy he was getting in on Dolloway and being able to swarm a little bit. And then it became pretty apparent that Dolloway was baiting Bisping to come in and then firing shots on the part when Bisping left on the parting shots. And Dolloway landed a couple good shots as Bisping exited out from flurries. And of course, at the end of the first round, Dolloway leveled him with that left hook. And in the second round, Bisping made a pretty sound adjustment. He picked his spots much more carefully on when he'd flurry. He only kind of charged in when he noticed that either Dolloway was off balance, or if he did come in, Bisping made sure to have an angle on the exit so that he wasn't kind of lined up for a nice parting shot the way he was in the first round. And Dolloway didn't really have much of an answer for that. He wasn't able to implement his game. And you can actually see in the second round, Dolloway's trying to bait Bisping to come in for more of those exchanges. And you can see Bisping is much, much more cautious of kind of getting into like full offense mode where he completely negates his defense. So that to me, that was a case of like Bisping recognizing his mistake and making a quick adjustment. And that's a sign of a good coaching, a good athlete. As much as people don't like Michael Bisping and talk about how he's arrogant and things like that, he seems like one of the more coachable athletes out there. He's smart about how he goes about things, and he seems to put a lot of thought process into how he fights. So, it's one of those, a performance like that, yeah, Bisping's going to be up and down. He's not going to be beating top five dudes in the middleweight division anytime soon again. But, I mean, I fully expect this guy, he'll be in the UFC for another 4 to 5 years if he's able to continue to fight like this. So, solid performance for him. CB Dolloway, I mean, it's just, you know, CB Dolloway is just going to kind of continue to hang out in the middle of that division. Again, good fighter, but just not a great fighter. And let's slide on down the card a little bit further. John McDessie landed a pretty sweet little ghost punch on Shane Campbell. Didn't see it from the live broadcast, but you just saw Campbell's head snap, and he went down. McDessie put in some big-time work on Campbell. Surprised me, to be perfectly honest. I thought Campbell would be able to challenge McDessie more on the feet. McDessie's shown that, I mean, he's a veteran. Lightweight division's no joke. Just an absolute shark tank. Let's see. Keep going down. Thomas Almeida. We'll be talking about him on MMA Perspectives for sure. But, I mean, just what an offensive dynamo Thomas Almeida is. mix together body shots and in really well to keep Yves Jaboyne kind of off balance, or should I say keep his defense off balance for the entirety of that fight and just set up the finish so beautifully. Almeida's got a bright future ahead of him, and we'll be talking about him on MMA Prospectus this Friday. Patrick Cote versus Joe Riggs, I will never, ever speak of this fight again. Alexis Davis gets a win over Sarah Kaufman. Sarah Kaufman looking to do the clean 3-0 sweep over Alexis Davis. It was looking pretty good for a while. Kaufman just seems to have Davis's number in a lot of departments. And then they hit the mat. Davis is able to land directly in the mount out of a takedown. And in like a just a super kind of like epitomizes what kind of things you need to be able to do to like get a jiu-jitsu black belt. And I know belts aren't always the most useful things, but like there are certain things that you notice when you roll with different levels and kind of like things that you notice kind of define like what it is to be that belt level. And one of the things is that if you give an advantage to a black belt on the mat, they very rarely ever give it back. And Davis was able to get the mount. And while she wasn't able to keep the mount, she kept the advantage that position gave her. She worked towards the mounted triangle. They rolled over. She stayed on the triangle. And she was actually pressed right into her corner and had Kyotera coaching her through the transition to that armbar. And Kaufman was trying to stand out of it, try to pull out, try to slide out. Very common reaction in no-gi. And, you know, she might have been baiting the armbar a little bit because, honestly, in no-gi, it's pretty easy to slip out of armbars, especially if you're on top and the person on bottom is going for an armbar. It's entirely possible Kaufman was trying to bait the armbar as a lower energy way to get out of the triangle. But Davis was able to hook Kaufman's near leg really well and then throw her leg over and transition immediately to the belly down armbar. And the belly down armbar, when your arm's extended, it's brutal. It's nasty. And ref completely out of position, missed the tap. Kaufman had to tap physically and verbally for a little while before Davis let go. And no problem with Davis holding on to it. It's professional fighting. Ref stops the fight. The other fighter doesn't stop the fight. And so, solid win for Alexis Davis. She was getting tuned up, but able to seize on an opportunity when it presented itself. The rest of the card, we'll probably touch on a couple of these fights on MMA Prospectus, so I'll leave them there. The other ones, if we're not going to touch on them, probably aren't worth really talking about on this show. So, that only leaves one thing left to do today. We are going to go in-depth on Demetrius Johnson's side control. So, side control is considered to be a dominant position, meaning that the person on top has a significant advantage over the fighter on bottom because the legs have been taken out of the picture. And so, when Demetrius Johnson just passes to side control, he has a lot of offensive options. The fighter on bottom, while has some offensive options, they are severely limited. Most of them are fairly risky. And most of your energy, if you're on bottom, is devoted towards escaping. Now, the first thing people use to escape from side control is their arms. And it's something that the top player has to deal with when they're playing side control. And there was actually a bit in the promo video where they showed Matt Hume teaching side control and specifically talking about how to deal with opponents pressing on you. That was really, really fantastic. And he was talking about the idea of kind of like not resisting when they push on you. Don't try to balance or push back. Because if you balance or push back, you go stiff. And it's very easy for a guy to kind of lift you off. And that always kind of goes with something that I've kind of come to think about side control, in that when guys try to use their arms, you really have two choices. You can either be a static weight, in which, like, when you go to the gym and you do the free weights and you clasp the, you know, the plates on either side of the bench press bar, you get them in nice and tight because you don't want those weights moving around. You want a static weight. Yeah, it's free. It can, you know, it's you're stabilizing the weight, but no part of the bar or the weights are moving. So that's very easy to lift. So you have to be very dynamic when you're in side control. You have to be able to move and kind of flow with the guy's movements, because that's going to make you very, very difficult for a guy to actually exert some strength on. And that's kind of seemed to what Matt Hume was teaching, and the idea that, like, if you let him push one shoulder, you shift your weight around so you kind of move into a different position without actually giving up the side control, and you kind of negate their strength. And that's a good strategy, but really, you want to take their arms out of the picture. And so here's a quick image of Demetrius Johnson when he fought Chris Carriasso. And you can see Carriasso's right arm, the dangling arm with the blue tape right there, has been taken out of the picture by Demetrius Johnson's legs. He has slid his knee kind of next to Chris Carriasso's head, and that's kind of like shelved Carriasso's right arm kind of on Demetrius Johnson's hip. This is the classic, like, first thing you learn in a jiu-jitsu class thing for side control. How to deal with that near side arm is you kind of shelve it in this position, and then there's not enough space if you stay nice and tight, and you can see good chest-to-chest contact from Demetrius Johnson here, that they're not able to bring it back in. The arm won't fit back in between you guys, and it's stuck in this rather compromised position. And when you have the arm stuck there, it's out of the game. It is no longer really a factor. And I believe that in this position, Demetrius Johnson also has the other arm. He's wrapped Carriasso's other arm. So now Carriasso is, both of his arms are kind of out of play, and Demetrius Johnson has a free arm. In this case, his right arm, which is nearer to Carriasso's legs. So what can he do with this position? Well, we're going to switch angles here and jump a little bit ahead in the fight, and you can see here that Demetrius Johnson has locked up a Kimura grip. That outside arm, the one that he hasn't trapped with his legs, is very, very exposed. Anytime an elbow comes away from the body, you know, your arm's in trouble from bottom. And Demetrius Johnson recognized this, that Carriasso's left arm in this case was kind of hanging up in the air, and he fought it down to the mat and locked up this Kimura grip. Now, once you get the Kimura grip, you can see here both Carriasso's arms are—they're done. They're completely controlled. Carriasso's left arm is in the Kimura right now. Now, Demetrius Johnson isn't in position to finish that Kimura, but he has the grip locked up, and that grip is very, very difficult to move around in. And Carriasso's right arm is currently shelved onto Demetrius Johnson's hip, and you can see there's not enough space for him to bring that arm in. He's very, very much stuck in this position. So now, once you're here, we're going to flip to a little quick video here. So the video you're about to see is from Ricardo Cavalcante, who is a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt who teaches in Las Vegas, Nevada. I believe he is the instructor of the guy who runs Open Mat Radio, which, if you're a Jiu-Jitsu guy and into sport jiu-jitsu, it's a pretty good podcast. It's a little sporadic at times, but very good interviews with big names in sport jiu-jitsu, and occasionally some MMA grapplers as well. So definitely worth your time. So here you see Cavalcante on top in the blue gi, and he's demonstrating how to get the grip. And he's not going to lock up the Kimura grip before he steps over, but that's not really the point here. So watch him step. He's going to take a big, long step, and he's going to basically trap the bottom guy's head and arm that's not being Kimura'd between his legs. You can have both knees on the mat. You can have one leg posted or the other leg posted, but you really can't have both legs posted for this position. You need to have at least one knee on the mat. And once you get here, the guy on the bottom is in big trouble. You can post on either side of his neck with either side of his head, I should say, with your knees. That works just as well. And I think we'll have a little quick shot of that later on. But this is actually the position, if we flip over to Demetrius Johnson here, this is actually the position he ended up in with Chris Carriasso. It was 1 foot planted, one on his knee, and Carriasso's head and arm stuck between the knees. And from here, Demetrius Johnson was able to finish a Kimura, north-south Kimura, which is my absolute jam. I love that submission. I go for it all the time in rolling. It's my number one go-to submission. Really, really reliable. And if you screw it up, you don't lose top position. So it's a big bonus. So that's kind of the traditional, that's a very traditional side control finish here. But let's take a look at what Demetrius Johnson did in the Horiguchi fight and has been doing. He does a lot of this. Another way to deal with the arms is he goes to the mounted crucifix. So he used this in the Carriasso fight, but here's a shot from the Horiguchi fight, actually just a couple moments before the submission. And you can see here, another way of taking the arms out of the picture is to step over
the arm. Not actually the head, just the arm. So you can see here that Horiguchi's left arm is now between Demetrius Johnson's knees, and his right knee is sitting next to Horiguchi's head. So Horiguchi's arm is quite literally just between between Demetrius Johnson's legs and coming up out from behind him. And in this position, the arm's pretty useless. There's not a lot he can push off of here. He can't really create space with that arm. It's not doing him any good. And on the other side, Demetrius Johnson has the other arm controlled, which leaves Horiguchi's face exposed for strikes. So that's all well and good, but how do you get here? Because this seems like a pretty dominant position. We've seen it used. I mean, you know, famously, Matt Hughes to BJ Penn used this position, and Roy Nelson used it to Kimbo Slice on The Ultimate Fighter. I mean, it's not exactly revolutionary jiu-jitsu or MMA tactics to get this position and punch away, but how do you get this position as reliably as Demetrius Johnson does? So we're going to jump to a video of Eric Paulson teaching how to get the crucifix from side control. Paulson is a former Shooto world champion, a Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt, a shooto fighter, really, really knowledgeable grappler, top-notch coach, and actually lost to Matt Hume, the coach of Demetrius Johnson. So here you can see that he's showing that he wants to attack that near side arm. He wants to control that near side arm, but how is he going to expose it? He exposes it with punches, and when the guy goes to defend the punches, he pins down the leg with his shin, and then is able to step over and trap the arm. And it's really, I mean, to a certain extent, it's kind of that simple in some respects, because Demetrius Johnson is so comfortable setting up the crucifix that he's able to use strikes to provoke a defensive reaction and then takes advantage of that defensive reaction. It's a really excellent little bit of MMA grappling that he uses pretty consistently. Just this simple little trick of controlling the forearm, throwing punches until the guy defends himself, and then he either slides his knee up to shelve the elbow like we looked at earlier, or he'll slide his knee shin across and pin it into the mounted crucifix like that. So it's one of the things that Demetrius Johnson has clearly invested time in this position. It's a position that not a lot of MMA fighters really seem to use much. A lot of MMA fighters seem to really prefer half guard for controlling opponents from the bottom because it gives you a little bit more control of their hips. There's a leg entanglement going on there, so it's harder for guys to escape back to their feet. Whereas I feel like in guys in side control, especially against some of the more explosive wrestlers that you're going to face, if you put a dude like that on their back, you want to keep him there. And you're not going to risk going to something like side control where a really hard bridge and roll could let the guy get up. So I feel like Demetrius Johnson, he's investing time in this position in a way that few other fighters are, and we're seeing results because of it. Now, if we go back to the fight, we left Horiguchi in this mounted crucifix here, but he's not going to stay there the whole time. He actually is able to bridge up and get to his hip and get to his side here. Now, you can see Horiguchi's arm resting across Demetrius Johnson's back. This arm is exposed. Demetrius Johnson, this is the arm Demetrius Johnson is going to armbar in the closing seconds of the match. But how he gets to that armbar is pretty interesting, because previously when we looked at the Kimura, Demetrius Johnson stepped over the head. And that's certainly an option here. But Demetrius Johnson actually chooses to go the other way and step over Horiguchi's body. And when I saw that, I was immediately reminded of this video of Billy Robinson. Now, Billy Robinson is one of the great last catch wrestling coaches that we had. And unfortunately, recently he passed away. But this man helped train, amongst others, Josh Barnett and Kazushi Sakuraba and all sorts of great grapplers. Like one of the last real stores of catch wrestling knowledge. And now that he's gone, that torch is passed on to Josh Barnett. But here he is actually teaching Barnett, and they're discussing like the idea of entries into submissions. And he's showing from this position, which I don't think is necessarily the most, like, it's not exactly a realistic fight position for MMA, but it's more demonstrating the concept. And what he's doing is he's showing Barnett that actually the step over the head one is not always the most efficient, or it can be the most efficient, I should say, but it's also predictable and counterable. And he shows the idea that Barnett should maybe step over the body instead and spin a little bit more dramatically to the armbar. And now this looks like a move that's mostly just for show, but it's one that creates some genuine confusion in the bottom grappler because there's a whole lot of movement involved and you end up in an armbar very, very quickly. And you can see here as Barnett picks up the speed on the technique, how it might be, or how it could, you could see it legitimately happening to somebody in a match. Not that you're going to get a guy laying face down on the mat with his arm extended quite that far, but again, it's more of a conceptual thing than it is like a practical application demonstration. So if you take this and then look at what Demetrius Johnson was doing in the match, he actually is going to step over Horiguchi and kind of come to the, like a standing mount position, almost like Barnett did when he stood over him, though Demetrius Johnson obviously stays quite a bit lower to keep control of Horiguchi's elbow, which you can see is pinched between Demetrius Johnson's neck and shoulder. And now, once he's here, he then steps over quickly for the armbar and then sits back and gets the arm fully extended to finish. So he actually is very much doing the armbar that Billy Robinson just demonstrated, just with a little bit more adaptations for live sparring application rather than the like the conceptual look we got. So it's a really cool little piece of grappling that I wonder if that's influenced by Hume's time in Japan, because Japan is, you know, Japan and shoot fighting are like one of the great. It's an area where catch wrestling is still very much alive. It's not, you know, the catch wrestling aficionados would say it's not true catch. It's not the pure English catch as catch can or the American catch as catch can. But it is one of the places where that style is still very much flourishing. So it was a really interesting little wrinkle that Demetrius Johnson threw in there to get yet another really nice armbar win, because I mean, Demetrius Johnson's quickly, sneakily becoming one of the better champions when it comes to submissions. I'm having a hard time thinking of a current champion that has, what, let's see, one, two, three, three submissions while defending his title. I'm not sure that we have one. If I'm forgetting one, feel free to send it to me. I'm at TP_Grant on Twitter, or you can shout at me in the comment thread on YouTube or the comment thread on Buddy Elbow. But I can't think of another champion that has three submissions and title defenses who's still currently champ. So, yeah, it's every time Demetrius Johnson gets on top, his guard passing, which we didn't even have time to look at, and his top control from the side control is just absolutely masterful. It's really, really fun to watch him. And I know I spent a lot of time today talking about how, you know, no one watches him and how he should never, like, really headline a pay-per-view again. And, I mean, that's kind of a fact of the numbers and where things are at right now. But as a fighter, I mean, you can't do anything but respect Demetrius Johnson. The dude is just so, he's athletically gifted. He's so technical. He's so smart about how he goes about everything. He's a lot of fun to watch. And I'll definitely be tuning in every time he goes in. And now that I say that, it sounds like such an MMA hipster thing to be talking about how you enjoy Demetrius Johnson fights, the way people used to talk about, like, enjoying John Fish fights. Ugh. All right, so I think that just is about does it today. So our next time we'll be back. The May 10th card between Hunt and Stipe Miocic is a Fight Pass card, and I have a pretty hard rule that I will not do Fight Pass cards just because I firmly believe that not all UFC cards are equal these days, and not all of them deserve the same amount of attention. And I don't think the concept of this show really fits on a show where you have really not that much going on. You have, I mean, Miocic and Hunt are both top 10 heavyweights, so that's going to be at least have some ramifications. But after that, I mean, it's a lot of figuring out, like, where people slot into the middle levels of their divisions. Very similar to how a lot of action on this card was kind of shuffling out, like, mid-tier fighters and figuring out where kind of everyone stacks up in their division. So we'll take that one off. We will be back for the fight night of Faber versus Edgar, which also has Gegard Mousasi going on it. Neil Magny will fight for like the 100th time in the last 24 months. Felipe Nover's back in the UFC, so it should be a pretty entertaining card. and we'll be back about that one. And it's almost here. We're almost to UFC 187, which should be absolutely bonkers. I cannot wait for that card. It should be incredible. So hopefully, fingers crossed, knock on wood, everyone on that card stays healthy, and we get what should be an absolutely outstanding event on May 23rd. Cannot wait for it. So until then, I am your host, TP Grant. This has been Inside the Guard. You can find me at TP_Grant on Twitter. You can also find me over at Bloody Elbow. I'm currently working on scouting the bantamweight division for our scouting report. Lots of good fighters there. A lot of Brazilians. A lot of people have been talking about how European-centric we are. And the people who didn't like how European-centric we are, they're going to like this division because a lot of American fighters, a lot of Brazilian fighters. This is the division you guys have been waiting for. Also, working on a little grappling piece with a grappler I've mentioned a couple times on this show. Not want to say too much, but it's going to be pretty cool. I'm really looking forward to this one. I think it's going to be informative and cause some people to think about a little bit deeper about grappling. So, until then, have a great week. This has been Inside the Guard.